Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, analysis following the first day of the Senate trial of the impeachment of Donald Trump. Our guest is National Affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, John Nichols. And also today, the annexation of northern Mexico by the United States and its relationship to the economic growth of the U.S., as well as U.S. immigration policies today. Chicano liberation and environmental activist Bill Gallegos breaks it down for us. For our Campaigners for Black Lives series, we speak with Haytham Farage, the attorney in the case of Kenneth Ross, who was killed by police in Gardena, California. Video was recently released that Kenneth Ross was unarmed, and there is new information about the police officer who killed Kenneth. Also, our weekly Earth Minute with Ann Peterman. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. The House impeachment managers begin making their opening arguments today in the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. They'll have 24 hours, but in a last-minute change, each side will have 3 days to make their case. CNN reports about 15 Republican senators pushed back against Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's plan to cram opening arguments into 2 12-hour days for each side. McConnell also reversed course and decided to allow the evidence the House collected during its impeachment proceedings to be entered as evidence automatically. But otherwise, McConnell prevailed on the key issues of subpoenas for witnesses and documentary evidence. The session stretched nearly 13 hours to almost 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Some senators nodded off. Republicans defeated all 11 Democratic amendments. They included proposals to subpoena materials from the White House, State, and Defense Departments and to subpoena Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and Senior White House aide Robert Blair. The debate on a subpoena for Bolton began at almost midnight, leading House Prosecutor Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff.
There's a reason why we're here to 5 to midnight, and that's because they don't want the American people to see what's going on here. They're hoping people are asleep. And you know, a lot of people are asleep right now, all over the country, because it's midnight. Now, maybe in my state of California, people are still awake and watching. But is this really what we should be doing when we're deciding the fate of a presidency? We should be doing this in the midnight hour?
After one particularly bitter post-midnight exchange, Chief Justice John Roberts intervened, taking the rare step of admonishing both the Democratic House managers prosecuting the case and the White House counsel to remember where they are. Speaking in Davos, Switzerland today, President Trump called House prosecutors Adam Schiff and Judiciary Chair Gerald Nadler sleazebags. And in response to a reporter's question, said he'd like to attend the Senate trial.
I'd love to go. Wouldn't that be great?
So
wouldn't that be beautiful?
Go?
I don't know. I'd sort of love to sit right in the front row and stare at their corrupt faces. I'd love to do it. I don't know. Don't keep talking because you may convince me to do it.
Do you think Cipollone and Sekulow would want you there?
I think they might have a problem.
Mr. President.
I think they might.
And by the way, I think they've done a really good job. And I think the other side has so lied. I watched the lies from Adam Schiff. He'll stand, he'll look at a microphone, and he'll talk like he's so aggrieved. These two guys, these are major sleazebags. They're very dishonest people.
Trump also said his administration soon would announce new additions to the U.S. controversial travel ban. The Wall Street Journal reports the new countries will be Belarus, Eritrea, Kyrgyzstan, Myanmar, Nigeria, Sudan, and Tanzania. The current ban on mostly Muslim nations applies to travelers from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, and North Korea, as well as political officials from Venezuela. Opening statements and the first witness testimony are expected today in Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein's New York City rape trial. Weinstein faces the possibility of life in prison if he's convicted. Brazilian prosecutors are accusing journalist Glenn Greenwald of involvement in hacking the phones of officials involved in a corruption investigation. Prosecutors are recommending charges against Greenwald, although Brazil's high court blocked investigations of the journalist and his Brazil-based news outlet in relation to the case. Greenwald's lawyers are calling the allegations bizarre. They do appear to be political. They came after Greenwald published evidence showing apparent collusion between a former judge, Sergio Moro, and prosecutors. Brazil's right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, has since appointed Moro the justice minister. The Oakland City Council voted unanimously to make that city the first in California to ban most landlords from using criminal background checks when considering tenants. Christina Onnested reports.
Formerly incarcerated people and family members shared their personal stories. Anita Wills, the policy outreach leader with Alameda Fair Chance for Housing, says her son's incarceration and criminal record prevented him from moving in with her after he was released from jail, making it harder for him to turn his life around.
Got in trouble when he was 18 years old. He could not live with me in any of the places that I lived in because I was getting assistance. And now the place that I'm in, the landlord specifically, because he's a private landlord, even though he's subsidized, he specifically says in his documents that no one with a record can live in his apartment.
According to a recent UC Berkeley survey at an Oakland homeless encampment, 73% of those living there were formerly incarcerated.
That's Christina Onnested. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth on Tuesday, January 21st, 2020, was the first day of the Senate trial of Donald Trump, who was impeached by the House. Overseeing the trial is Supreme Court Justice John Roberts. Key things to watch in the trial include whether witnesses would be called, and when and by whom, as well as whether the Senate would subpoena documents the White House denied the House. Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, prior to the start of the trial, announced he will coordinate the trial with the White House, raising the question of the fairness of the trial. He also promised a quick trial, and true to his word at the start of the trial, he proposed rules that would have squeezed 24 hours of opening arguments into 2 days for each side. Secondly, he proposed language that would not automatically admit evidence from the House impeachment probe unless there was a formal vote to include them. But McConnell was ultimately forced to revise his suggested rules in a compromise with dissented opinions within his own party. Under the current and updated structure, now the time has been expanded to 3 days for opening arguments. In another small but significant win for Democrats, findings from the House impeachment probe will automatically be entered into evidence as part of the trial. As it stands now, we are told the proposed rules for Trump's impeachment trial will largely mirror the ones used for the trial of former President Bill Clinton. The House, to remind you, charged Trump with abuse of power and obstructing Congress, but Republicans have argued that Trump should not be found guilty because the House did not specifically charge Trump with actual crimes. But Democrats argue that the framers of the Constitution said that a president could be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, and legal scholars argue that the case lawyers are making for Donald Trump basically is constitutional nonsense. This was reported in the New York Times. Furthermore, scholars say the federal criminal code didn't even exist at the time of the drafting of the Constitution. Another area to watch is whether and which Republican senators will break ranks. All eyes are on Mitt Romney of Utah, Susan Collins of Maine, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, all of whom express opposition to McConnell's strategy of total coordination with the White House. In order to secure a majority, Democrats would need at least one more Republican to break ranks. on witnesses. I saw one headline this morning, but it was a little unclear, that said John Bolton would not be called. There's been a lot of focus on his willingness to testify and whether he would be called. But it seems that the big vote on witnesses won't happen until a week or two into the trial, after opening arguments and questions from senators. Only on one amendment, which was to allow more time to file motions, did a single Republican, Senator Collins of Maine, join with Democrats. But it, too, was rejected in a 52-48 vote. The Senate also rejected three Democratic amendments to subpoena documents and other records from the White House, the State Department, and the Office of Management and Budget related to the Ukraine probe. Keep in mind that Republicans hold a 53-47 majority. And how popular is Trump's impeachment with the general public? One poll, a USA Today Suffolk University poll conducted in December of 2019, found that 45% of respondents supported the impeachment and removal of Trump from office, while 51% opposed it. Here to break all of this down, give us some analysis, his views on all of this. Some see it as a circus going on. Others are taking it much more seriously. With this impeachment trial, we'd like to welcome John Nichols. He's a pioneering political blogger. He writes about politics for The Nation magazine as its national affairs correspondent. His posts have been circulated internationally, quoted in numerous books, and mentioned in debates on the floor of Congress. John also hosts Next Left, The Nation's podcast, featuring interviews with rising progressive politicians who explain how they plan to change the United States for the better. He's also a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. His articles have also appeared in the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, dozens of other newspapers, and you likely saw him on MSNBC and other television broadcast. John Nichols, it's been way too long. Welcome.
Margaret, it has been way too long, and I'm really honored to be with you. I'm also really struck by what a great job you did on sort of summing up all of the issues that are in play. I wish some of our TV broadcasters would do so well.
Well, I wanted to check with you to see if you thought actually I'd gotten it a bit, had gotten it right there. But I also wanted to get your thoughts on what happened yesterday. I mean, we saw that the Democrats had a small win. How small was it? How significant it is? But we also got an indication from the Republicans that they're pretty much closed ranks. It remains to be seen who's going to break, if anybody. John Nichols.
Well, you're exactly right. And so let's pause for a moment and step back and look at the core of what we're dealing with here. The President of the United States has been impeached. That is a very rare thing. And now we are at trial. This trial appears, by most measures, to be corrupted. It has been corrupted by the leader of the Senate, who has signaled that he is coordinating with the White House in order to achieve a decision that benefits the White House. And you saw yesterday a very sort of blunt attempt by that leader, the majority leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, to warp the process in a way that would effectively speed it up and exclude those elements, those ideas, those facts, details, and those testimonies that might move the decision-making process in a way that would be non-beneficial or detrimental to the president. So all of that we know. That's our reality, and we, I think we understand that. I think most people who are listening understand that well. And yet yesterday, I would suggest that the Democrats won the day. They had a remarkable day because they understood something deeper, and that is that this is not merely a discussion inside the Senate with some of the House managers. This is also a national discussion. People are watching this. And so there is a decision that will be made in the Senate. There is a likelihood that that decision will favor Donald Trump, that he will remain in office, that the Republicans will not break. But this is an election year, and so we also have the will of the people, the decision of the people as regards this. And what the Democrats did, I thought rather brilliantly summed up by Congressman Hakeem Jeffries when he spoke last evening in prime time about some of these amendments, was they put the evidence into their discussion of the amendments to McConnell's proposal. They effectively seized every opening they had to, again, and this is in Hakeem Jeffries' terms, to speak to the American people. And I think that is a highly effective approach. Now, I know that there are many listeners to this show, I'm sure, many folks who would say, yeah, but, you know, it's not going to result in his immediate removal from office. That is perhaps, that's likely to be true. But what's being done here, putting the evidence into the mix in prime time, doing so as effectively as Val Demings, Hakeem Jeffries, Adam Schiff, and some others did, I think that has an effect on the long-term political prospects of Donald Trump. And so I do see this as, you know, working on two levels, and on perhaps the most powerful level, the Democrats, I think, had a very effective night.
Yeah, I happen to agree with you. I mean, I didn't see everything, but what I saw, clearly what they were going for was definitely giving the general public as much information as possible, and for the trial to happen, for the jurors, in a way, to be also the general public. And John Nichols, a lot was made of Nancy Pelosi's strategy on this, just out of the gate, and also delaying, you know, getting moving over to the Senate. And also a lot of people on your last point saying, well, at the end of the day, the Democrats don't have the vote in the Senate, so why bother with all of this? But it does seem to me anyway as though she knows what she's doing and that the case is being laid out very, very clearly. Now, there was a bit of a dust up late last night where John Roberts, you know, had to say to both sides, look, you need to tone it down a little bit, you know. This is, you know, the most important deliberative body in the world. I don't know that I would, you know, that
I'm
being here nor there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But what about the Democratic strategy and Nancy Pelosi's role in particular?
Sure. Nancy Pelosi took a lot of criticism from advocates for impeachment over the last couple of years who felt that she was waiting too long. She chose to wait because she said that she needed something tangible to work with, something more tangible than what was already in play. I happen to disagree. I think she should have moved earlier, but that's my opinion. With that said, as somebody who kind of disagreed in the past, I think what's happening now is strategically very smart. And I would also say that it's what Nancy Pelosi is now doing in coordination with Chuck Schumer. And one of the things that's happening here is that you're sort of blending and merging what the House discovered, what the House put in play, into the Senate process. And I would suggest that yesterday, in the debate about the amendments, you saw a very effective blending. And I have to give Pelosi some coordinating credit for that. I have to give Schumer some coordinating credit for that. But I think the most important thing that Pelosi did was in working with the committees to name the impeachment managers. Now, I'll ask you, Margaret, because you're a really savvy observer of politics and how people communicate. Don't you think those managers just did a stellar job?
Yes.
They were really effective.
Yeah, and I was also, I'll have to say, even though I'm not a great fan of police chiefs for some other reasons, but Val Demings, I mean, not only in her performance in the House, but I also thought her presentation here was really quite impressive. And the managers chosen for, you know, their experience in terms of litigation, etc. So I agree with you. Demings, member of Intelligence and Judiciary Committees, and for our audience in Southern California in particular, who are great fans of Maxine Waters and known as Anti-Maxine, and Maxine Waters has been somebody who has consistently talked about impeaching Donald Trump, and some may be wondering, well, why wasn't Maxine Waters part of that team? But I do think that it was a purposeful and effective selection, and we'll see how it goes. But thus far, they seem to be doing well. I wanted to ask you also about the Republicans, and if you. What you have any predictions on any of them breaking ranks? The senator from Colorado, some people had hoped that he would be one of those, but it seems as though that's really not going to be the case. Cory Gardner, a vulnerable Republican. Any thoughts on Republicans to watch?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on that. And this is a trial, and anybody who has ever watched a trial, you know, a TV drama or a movie about a trial, knows that sometimes they take unexpected twists and turns. There's a revelation, there's a detail, there's a development that you didn't see coming. And I don't rule that out. And so I think that's the critical question. Is there something so substantial that might yet come into play, or some twist in this that might yet open up a space where at least a few Republicans will break? On the pattern that we're on right now, I don't anticipate breaks. I think they have tended to hold very tightly. You saw that in the amendment votes right there. But there are a group of Republicans who are at least potential. And you listed most of them. I would add one more, and that is Mike Lee, the other Republican senator from Utah. It's been quite evident for a long time. Mike Lee does not like Donald Trump all that much.
Yeah.
Lee broke very effectively with Trump on the Iran war stuff, the possibility of an Iran war, and stood with people like Bernie Sanders, in criticizing the rush to war. And so I think he and Romney are the two that I would keep the closest eye on. I don't think that one of them would go without the other. My sense is that there is at least an outside prospect that the two senators from Utah, both of whom are very, very safe in their seats, could be the ones to whom a practical and a moral appeal might be made on constitutional grounds. And I hope that continues. If I was a manager, a Democratic manager on this, I'd be aiming a lot of my arguments toward them. And frankly, the movement folks who are supportive of impeachment, I think, you know, they put a lot of energy on Susan Collins. Susan Collins almost always lets folks down. I'm not anticipating a lot there. I would put energy into Salt Lake City and into Utah. That's where to, you know, at least one area to try and, you know, put that crack in. And then if Romney and Lee were to move, right, if they were to break in some way, then I think it creates the space where you might see a Collins, a Murkowski, who's frankly spoken out quite well on at least some of these issues, particularly on having, you know, a better trial, and maybe even a Cory Gardner. So I don't want to be naive about this. I don't want to be some starry-eyed optimist. But what I would suggest is that a deeply constitutionally based argument with sound, you know, a sound case being made, A, that the Constitution was basically written for a moment like this, and B, that there is a duty, not just to the moment, but to the future, to hold this president to account, that does aim at Romney and Mike Lee. I don't entirely rule out the prospect that something like that could work. And I won't until the day the final Senate vote occurs. But with that said, again, I'll conclude by saying I'm not naive. You know, it's a tall hill to climb.
Yeah, and I know you have to dash, but two quick things I wanted to have you weigh in on. One, how you think the Trump team is doing, and any thoughts on the role of Dershowitz there. And also, this business about the new evidence, people calling the bombshell evidence by Lev Parnas. Bloomberg, there's an article in Bloomberg today that's saying the headline, Trump's impeachment trial isn't his biggest legal risk. Can campaign finance violations bring down a president? So your thoughts on any of this?
Fabulous, fabulous place to circle around to, Margaret. I enjoy talking to you so much on these things. The Republicans have done a miserable job. It may not matter.
Yeah.
Because when the trial has been warped, when it has been corrupted, when the balance has been placed on the side of the president, the failure of the president's lawyers to do a good job may not matter. I hate to say that, but that is simply a reality. And we know that. Look, you know that from history of jurisprudence in this country, right? There have been places where a court wasn't going to do the right thing no matter how good the lawyers were, or no matter how bad the lawyers were. And so that's a reality we have to deal with. But this is a uniquely bad defense. And the reason it is so bad is because the president is clearly directing it himself. If you had simply said, hey, look, we're partisan Republicans, we have to mount the most effective defense for Donald Trump, you wouldn't have these lawyers doing it.
Yeah.
These people are simply folks who will do what the president says they have to do. And that's a bad lawyer. A good lawyer says to a client, okay, you want to get off, and, you know, I believe you should get off. I believe that you're not guilty of this, or at least it can't be proven or whatever. Here's how to do it. In this case, it's clear Trump is directing it, and that's why people like Dershowitz are in play. And Dershowitz is a stunningly bad advocate. You know, I mean, he brings all of his own baggage. That's true.
Epstein.
But more than that, he brings the baggage of what he said in previous impeachment trial. You know,
yeah.
He's been on all sides of these issues. That's what makes it renders him so ineffective. And he also he does something that is deeply, deeply cynical. He's not alone in this. I think that most of Trump's lawyers do this. They selectively, you know, take elements of history and they say, oh, well, in the Andrew Johnson trial, somebody did this back in 1868. So we shouldn't even consider what the Democrats are saying. No, anyone who knows the history of impeachment, and I wrote a book about it, anyone who knows the history of impeachment knows the reason that this power was created was to address abuses of office. Donald Trump has been charged with abusing his position in order to advance himself politically. There's a lot of other charges against him, but at that core argument, that's why this power exists. And for Alan Dershowitz or anybody else to try and argue, as they are trying to argue, that impeachment wasn't created to address abuses of office of the sort in which this president is engaged, that is the most profoundly absurd and dishonest argument. And it ought to be challenged at every turn, because we can't let this become an accepted part of the historical record.
Right.
We have duties to history here.
Yeah, yeah. And for the senators, their duty to history, they feel, is to get reelected. The Constitution and the rest of it be damned. But John Nichols, sadly, we're going to have to leave it there. There's so much I want to pick your brain about, not only about impeachment, but the election, et cetera. So we likely will be calling on you some more. And for our listeners, if you're not familiar with the work of John Nichols, just suggest you check him out regularly in The Nation. And John Nichols, thank you so very much for joining us. We appreciate you.
Margaret, it is such a pleasure to join you.
All righty. You take good care now. All righty. Bye. We are going to take a short station break, and then coming up, our weekly Earth Minute. And then we're going to be talking about the U.S. annexation of northern Mexico and implications for U.S. policy today, and also campaigners for Black Lives. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Alrighty, the late, great, incredible Aretha Franklin, Bridge Over Troubled Water. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are also on Facebook. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us there. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. And we're also heard around the nation and around the world on SoundCloud. And all of our back shows are also archived there, by the way. And in our tradition, we want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Atlanta, Georgia, and internationally. We want to get, well, we have Romero saying a double whammy today internationally. That's Mexico City, Mexico, and Kiev in the Ukraine. And we are now going to go to our weekly Earth Minute.
In March, New York will join California in banning single-use plastic bags. While this can certainly be a good step toward less production of ocean-killing plastics, we must be sure they are not simply replaced with other throwaways that may be as much or more destructive. Cardboard containers coated with non-recyclable materials, for example, as well as disposable, compostable, or wooden cutlery and paper bags, all may result in higher emissions of greenhouse gases and contribute to deforestation. What we really need is an elimination of single-use materials altogether. Beyond recycle, we need to embrace the other two points of the triangle, reduce and reuse. An elimination of plastic bags or straws will not solve our problem. It might help us feel better, but we must have a real shift in how our society thinks about consumption. When did we switch from being humans to being consumers anyway? If we are to find a way out of the ecological catastrophe unfolding all around us. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. The U.S. has a long and bloody history of invading Mexican and indigenous lands. Between 1845 and 1848, the U.S. violently annexed Mexico's northern territories, which today comprise of California, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, and Colorado. This after annexing Texas in 1845 and displacing indigenous nations in the region off their lands. And between 1916 and 1917, during the height of the Mexican Revolution, the U.S. Army led an unsuccessful expedition into the northern state of Chihuahua. Their U.S. troops sought to capture revolutionary leader Pancho Villa, who was described as a bandit and terrorist by Washington. While today's drug cartels are certainly far from being anything close to revolutionary leaders like Pancho Villa, many Mexicans feel that their potential designation as terrorist organizations could potentially lead to a new U.S. invasion of their lands. The U.S. war against Mexico was motivated primarily by Southern U.S. slave owners who sought new territories for their plantations plantation economy and lucrative slave trade. During the time of annexation, Mexico took a stand against slavery, a country that elected its first African-descended president, Vicente Guerrero, in 1829. Before the U.S. war of aggression against Mexico, the two nations were roughly equal in size. A lot of people don't know that. However, on December 29, 1845, the Republic of Texas was officially annexed into the U.S., admitted to the Union as the 28th state. And the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848 ratified the rest of the theft, with Mexico now being confronted with a nearly 2,000-mile imposed border with a militarily superior power. While the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo promised that existing landowners in what became U.S. territories would not lose ownership of their land, these promises were not kept, and Mexicans were stripped of their assets. 525,000 square miles of land were roughly taken through force, murder, and trickery. And now, of course, the very people are accused of being illegal for coming across into land that basically had been taken from them. Let us go, before welcoming our guests, to a clip reflecting some of this history.
The American West conjures images of adventure, lawlessness, and opportunity. But what possessed us to go west in the first place? It all traces back to an important but not very well-known conflict in the mid-19th century called the Mexican-American War. In the 1840s, America was a pretty young country, and it was hungry to expand. President James K. Polk was especially eager to acquire more territory. He believed in manifest destiny. That's the idea the United States had a duty to expand westward across the North American continent. There was a lot of incentive for American settlers to go west. They could spread religion, strike it rich in business, or just get a fresh start. Needless to say, America's neighbor, Mexico, wasn't thrilled about the westward expansion craze. Both countries were already on thin ice. Mexico was bitter about losing Texas to the U.S. after it won its independence in 1836. President Polk wanted California and New Mexico, too, and he offered Mexico $30 million to purchase them. But they refused to sell. But hang on, conquering the West was America's manifest destiny, right? So Polk wouldn't take no for an answer. He picked a fight, sending troops to occupy a disputed area of the Texas and Mexico border. And when American troops and the Mexican cavalry clashed, Polk seized the opportunity to declare war on Mexico on May 13, 1846. Ultimately, Mexico was unprepared for war. Its internal politics were just a mess, and its cavalry couldn't measure up against the expertise of the U.S. military. After 2 years of fighting, Mexico was defeated, and in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, it ceded a third of its territory to the U.S., areas that include modern-day Utah, California, Nevada, Arizona, and Texas. The Mexican-American War had a major impact because it resulted in one of the largest territorial expansions of the United States. It also launched the careers of a few generals you may have heard of, future U.S. President Zachary Taylor and Civil War titans Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant.
Texas. It's the second largest U.S. state in both size and population, but it's second to none when it comes to state pride. To truly understand how much Texans love their state, you have to go all the way back to March 1836. That's when a group of Texas rebels signed a Declaration of Independence from Mexico. At the same time, about 200 Texans, including Colonels James Bowie and William B. Travis, and famed frontiersman Davy Crockett, were facing off against a massive Mexican army at the Alamo. After a two-week siege, Mexican troops overran the Alamo, killing nearly every last defender. The Texans may have lost the battle, but time spent on the siege distracted Mexican troops while Texas revolutionaries started to plot their next move. Just 5 weeks later, Remember the Alamo served as a rallying cry for the ragtag Texas Army as it finally won independence from Mexico at the Battle of San Jacinto. The new Republic of Texas's Lone Star flag became the fourth flag since 1519 to fly over Texas, after the French, Spanish, and Mexican. Texas remained independent from 1836 to 1845, when it became part of the United States. During the American Civil War, pro-slavery Texas joined the Confederacy. The Confederate flag became the sixth to fly over Texas.
You know, to our guests and our listeners, I wanted to play that just so you get the kind of tone that is these topics are discussed in relation to, you know, anyway, a bit absurd. But it does give some of that background. And Bill Gallegos, a longtime Chicano liberation and environmental justice activist, author of The Sunbelt Strategy and Chicano Liberation and Reflections on the Green Economy, also the former executive director of Communities for a Better Environment, one of the leading environmental justice organizations in the U.S., and he recently authored an article entitled Ethnic Cleansing, a Program of Resistance, and he also has an article in Liberation Road, The Historical and Political Significance of the U.S. Annexation of Mexico's Northern Territories. Bill Gallegos, welcome back.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you for that glowing introduction.
yeah, I tell you, I mean,
writing, you know,
the upbeat tone in those clips, you know, when such serious matters are being described, like stealing people's land and killing a whole set of people. But Bill Gallegos, in your article, you talk about the original peoples that populated the hemisphere even before the rise of the Mexican state. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I just want to say, just take a little off of the clip you just played before I came on, because the speaker mentioned that Texas joined the Confederacy. And I think a lot of people don't know that there was a large armed uprising against the Yankees in Texas led by Juan Cortina.
Uh-huh.
And he joined with the forces of the United States against the Confederates during the Civil War. A lot of folks don't know that there is that history as well.
Yeah, and a lot of folks don't know that a lot of the people enslaved, Africans enslaved, fled to Mexico and took refuge there as well. So there's that long history of collaboration
That's
and
right.
solidarity.
That's right. The Underground Railroad ran south and north, but
yeah.
It ran south and people don't know that. So what I wanted to just talk about here was something that's, I think, often overlooked by a lot of progressive and left historical commentators and folks on the left, which is the historical importance of this, the United States annexation, annexing Mexico's northern territories. So I think this is, the way I characterize this is that there are three major historical events, not the only ones, but there are three that are foundational to constructing the United States as a white supremacist capitalist superpower, and that dominates the world. We see that going on now. So the first phase was, of course, the genocide of the native peoples and dispossession from their land, seizure of their lands and resources. The second was the importation and exploitation of Africans as slave labor, which really enabled the kickstart of the U.S. capitalist economy. And the third that laid the basis for eventual U.S. global hegemony was the theft of Mexico's northern territories. And that annexation largely through military aggression, which, by the way, was opposed by Ulysses S. Grant as imperialist and by then Congressman Abraham Lincoln. But it enabled the United States to become a superpower rather than maybe France, or something like France or Spain, a second or third rate capitalist power, because the territorial acquisition enabled it spread its reach from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast. And this allowed for a vast expansion of the Anglo-European population as primarily settler colonists in these newly acquired territories. So it allowed for this coast-to-coast expansion, making it one of the largest countries in the world.
Yeah, and Bill, I just wanted to add to that also. I mean, you're absolutely right. A lot of people didn't realize that the territory of the U.S. and Mexico were about equal in size. And I just want to bring in the Haitian Revolution here also, because it was because of the Haitian Revolution that the U.S. was able to expand its territory greatly by kicking the French out. And people say the Louisiana Purchase, and they don't realize that it included Arkansas, Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Minnesota, Louisiana, South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, parts of Colorado, and parts of New Mexico. So yeah, that, you know, over 500 million acres. So you could see the significance then of the theft from Mexico and what the result of the Haitian Revolution meant for that expansion as well, Bill.
Absolutely. Yeah, so when they acquired these territories, what did they acquire? They acquired some of the most fertile agricultural lands in the world, but lands that are also rich in old oil, coal, uranium, gold, silver, copper, other, you know, very, very important mineral deposits. And, you know, what's profoundly important for becoming a global powerhouse, a superpower, they acquired the maritime access to the trade and resource extraction along the entire Pacific Rim. Otherwise, they would not have controlled ports on the Pacific. So these elements enabled the United States to assume the dominant position that it does today. But it also had a huge impact on Mexico, because Mexico then became subordinated to U.S. interests. It became a neocolonial dependent country, constantly subject to U.S. aggression, both military and political, and enormous economic penetration, which we now see in this new NAFTA agreement that's just been ratified by Congress. So it not only had an impact on this United States becoming a superpower, but it had a huge impact on the nation of Mexico, sealing its neocolonial dependent status. And we see what the result of that is now along the border as the United States pursues its ethnic cleansing campaign, the militarization of the border, and just horrendous crimes against humanity, like the separation of nearly 6,000 children from their families, the death of children and others along the border that have been seized by the Border Patrol and ICE. And by the way, Margaret, those 5,400 or 5,500 children that have been separated from their families, hundreds will never be reunited. Never. The United States authorities have lost all the contact information. They have no idea where their parents are, no idea where their families are, and they don't give a damn where they are. So what is going to happen to those children? And what is the pain of those families? So these are things that are just, they should be high on the headlines of the United States. And it's, you know, I'm glad you had that conversation with John Nichols, because, you know, anything that puts pressure on POTUS, the pesticide of the United States, Agent Orange, I think is really, really important. But we can't lose sight of what is central to the campaign of Donald Trump and the new right, the new Confederacy, which is the question of immigration. And it bothers me a lot that in the Democratic debates, this is not made a major item of discussion.
Yes, just
they can't take a pass on this. They have got to take it on, and they've got to challenge it face on as a violation of human rights.
Right. And it can't be just because this, the whole issue of the kidnapping of the children, what is happening now, the horror that's happening to the migrants that are trying to make their way, and the white mailing of the U.S., the crackdown on Obrador of the Mexican government to do its dirty work for them, which is basically to attack these migrants and to keep them from getting anywhere near to the U.S. Border. And people kind of forget about that. It's like, well, it's not high in the news cycle. But Bill, finally, because we're going to have to continue this discussion and have you back. Hopefully we'll be able to do that next week. But I'm also very worried about the way the new ways, some of which are old, of trying to divide black and brown communities here. And I wonder if you have some thoughts about that. It really is a worry, because because when we look at some of the most impoverished people in the United States, you see indigenous people, you see immigrant people, obviously also black people. But we can't forget that and drink that Kool-Aid to divide us. Bill Gallegos.
Absolutely. And Margaret, I think you're getting to the most important question that we have to face as a progressive movement, as a left movement, which is the question of strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we bring together at the core of this progressive, revolutionary, transformative movement that we want to build, the 37 million people of the Chicano-Mexicano population in the U.S. and the 35 million people, African-American, 36 million African-Americans. The majority of African-American population resides in the South. The overwhelming majority, 90% of the 37 million Chicano-Mexicano population, resides in our historic pre-annexation areas in Texas, California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado. What does it mean if we can bring these two oppressed peoples together, not alone, but as a core of the alliance that we need to really win immediate transformation, immediate reforms, but also long-term transformation of this country? Because our two peoples, we have nothing to lose but our change. That is not a cliche. That is a reality for us. And we are the ones that will benefit the most from the kind of radical transformation that is at the heart of our struggles. And that's why this question of the annexation is important, because it's often overlooked in discussions about strategy.
Right. Well, Bill Gallegos, we're going to have to leave it there. We're waiting for our Campaigners for Black Lives segment. But please join us again just over very, very shortly so we can continue this discussion. And we hope then that you'll be able to share one of your poems with us, Bill Gallegos.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us. Yeah. We're going to wrap our show up now with some new information on the murder of Kenneth Roth, who was killed in Gardena, California, by the police. I think it was in 2018. But let's welcome our guest, Haytham Faraj. We partner, by the way, with Black Lives Matter LA for our weekly Campaigners for Black Lives segment. So we thank them. And Haytham, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Okay. So Kenneth Roth, 25 years old, shot by Michael Robbins. This was June of 2018. What are we now learning about this murder?
So it was actually April of 2018.
April. Okay. Sorry about that.
Mm-hmm. No problem. Black Lives Matter successfully obtained the videos that the city withheld from the public for more than a year, almost 2 years.
Wow.
And what those videos reveal is a cold-blooded shooting. I mean, it's painful to look at.
Mm.
We will be releasing, or Black Lives will be releasing, some of those videos. The mendacity of the city of Gardena is unbelievable. Before they released the videos, even though we filed a lawsuit and we requested that we get the videos, they refused to disclose them. But then they turned around and made their own skit, their own sort of video movie of the videos. They picked and chose the portions that would benefit their narrative, and then they put it out on the public, to the public on YouTube, to make it look like the killing was justified. We will be releasing a video today, or Black Lives Matter will be releasing a video today that actually has the raw footage, and it will allow the public to make its own conclusions rather than rely on the false narrative by the city of Gardena and the city of Gardena Police Department.
So we're making news here, that raw footage released today, and we hope to be able to get it and post it and help to circulate it. So it's just outrageous. I mean, they just doctored the video, as you say, to fit their narrative. That's bloody outrageous. And
you know,
also...
They edited things. I mean, it's not doctored as in they created things, but they edited the videos in a way to make it seem like the shooting was justified.
Yeah, well, to me, that's a kind of a doctoring, right? I hear what you're saying,
absolutely,
though. It's not
absolutely
the formal definition of doctoring, but it is a way of retelling the story.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, to make matters worse, this is Michael Robbins' fourth shooting. Now, I don't know if
what?
The other three were also black men, but I wouldn't be surprised. His fourth shooting, when the call comes in over the radio, he he testified to this to homicide investigators afterwards, who eventually cleared him. But he says something to the effect of, oh, this is going to be good, when he hears that there is possibly a shooter nearby, and that the suspect has been seen. The suspect turns out.
Oh, wait a minute. This officer, Michael Robbins, when he heard about this, he said this is going to be good. When he.
Before he shoots.
Before he shoots.
He arrives at the scene where two other police officers are giving chase to a mentally disabled young man, Kenneth Ross. He has schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. He's known in the neighborhood. He's peaceful. He just walks around waving his arms in the air and talks to himself.
Yeah.
The other two police officers on the scene give chase, but they don't fire. They see there's nothing in this young man's hands. Robbins pulls up in his police cruiser, immediately takes out the AR-15, aims in, and shoots him, killing him. And then later, the homicide investigators says that his two shots were just amazing. His words, quote, just amazing. It's infuriating to look at. It's sad to look at. And it is emblematic of the type of police misconduct that is so pervasive in our society today.
Right now, you are an attorney trying to get some justice here. So where are things are now with this case?
Well, the L.A. district attorney declined to press criminal charges after the investigation, quote unquote, cleared Michael Robbins. We decided to file a civil lawsuit on behalf of Kenneth young 6-year-old son and his mother, Fuzia Almaru. We are in the early stages of litigation. We have filed our complaint. We're waiting for the city to file an answer, which we expect to happen in about 2 weeks.
Right. Yeah. And you are in touch with the family and his mom, sadly, his young son. How are they doing? How are they holding up? What a terrible tragedy.
His mom is devastated. You know, she was a single mom, and he was her best friend.
Mm.
He was her firstborn. They lived together. Mm-hmm. He would also go see his dad, who lived in the city of Gardena. She has little Kenneth. He has a mother. I mean, his mother's in his life also, but, you know, she sees little Kenneth, Kenneth Watts' son, the deceased. His name is also Kenneth. And so she sees the deceased Kenneth and her grandchild now. But it's tragic. It's devastating to this family.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing you never recover from. I'm a mom, and I just can't imagine. I mean, my heart so much goes out to that family, and really, really hoping that some justice will be seen in this case. But it really, what about this cop, by the way? I know we just have a couple of minutes, but what has happened to him? This kind of, because he sounds like, you know, this is going to be good, you know, almost like he's riding in on a, you know, old Western to pull his weapon and shoot somebody.
Yeah, that's exactly what it looks like. You'll see the video soon, but the way he approaches this situation is just like that, as some cowboy or someone who gives no thought to the fact that he is engaging a human being. There was, to be fair, there was a report of guns fired. No one was reported to have been shot or killed, but that there were bullets fired at a nearby location. And the suspect reported over the radio as a black man with dreadlocks. Well, if you've been to Raleigh Park or on Van Ness and City of Gardena, there are plenty of black men with dreadlocks. When I went to canvass the neighborhood,
I'm black with dreadlocks.
and this young man was at a corner when they first approached, and then he begins to jog away. His hands are empty. They can clearly be seen on the video.
Yeah.
The two other police officers don't do anything. They just give chase, which is fine. You know, had they tased him, it would be fine.
Yeah.
Because they believe that he is the person, and he happens to be running. Robbins takes a different course of action. He waits until he passes his police cruiser, and then he shoots him in the back.
In the back.
I mean,
okay. Haytham Faraj, I mean, this is just such a heartbreaking. And for people who want to know more about this campaign to get justice for the police murder of Kenneth Roth, I think if you go onto the social media for Black Lives Matter LA, you can get that information. But we thank you, Haytham Faraj, for the work you're doing.
Thank you. Would you please join us today at 211 West Temple Avenue at the Hall of Justice? Black Lives Matter will be holding a rally at 5 p.m. Today at 5 p.m., 211 West Temple at the Hall of Justice. Please come out and support Black Lives Matter on this issue and many others like it.
Today. Okay. We'll try to get that up on our social media as well. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including assistant producer Romero Funes and today's audio engineer. I'd like to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org. Follow us on Facebook, our handle on Twitter and Instagram, @SoTrueRadio. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.